on our way to church, Elizabeth came up to me and asked me to forgive her for something, and I said, yes, baby. We're doing a study on forgiveness tonight, so I'm happy to do that. But in all seriousness, we're continuing our study in 2 Corinthians, and we're going to be talking tonight about forgiveness and some other things. But 2 Corinthians 2, 10 through 11 is the passage that we're going to be reading. So if you do have a Bible, turn to 2 Corinthians 2, 10 through 11. I'm going to read that, and then we will get started. 2 Corinthians 2, 10 through 11. Anyone whom you forgive, I also forgive. Indeed, what I have forgiven, if I have forgiven anything, has been for your sake in the presence of Christ, so that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. Now, last week, Marcus talked about verse 10, and this week we're going to be talking about verse 11, and I'm going to read that again, so that we will not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. Now, when you think about fighting the devil, what comes to mind? You don't have to actually answer, but just think about how you would answer that question if you could. Now imagine that many people, when you talk about fighting the devil, many people are probably slightly embarrassed by that question, maybe feel a little bit awkward by that question, and so you have two different groups of people that are predominant in the church. You have those who may be a little bit nervous about that, and then you do have another group, maybe, and I don't know if there's many in this group, but there is another group who are all about fighting the devil, and they have all sorts of strategies that come to mind, and activities that they participate in that may be a little bit weird and strange, and you wonder, you know, where in the Bible do you see some of these things? But as I said, I imagine that many people in the church, if you start talking about fighting the devil, they might feel slightly embarrassed by that thought. And one of the things that really is kind of, it's really, really kind of significant when you think about it, is that when you think about the kind of songs that the church is putting out in general, there don't seem to be a whole lot of songs that really talk about God, like about Satan, demons, angels. We sang one tonight, but I can't think of a very long list of songs that where we naturally talk about the supernatural in such a direct sort of way. But anyways, I imagine that many people, when you talk about fighting the devil, you might feel a little bit embarrassed or uncomfortable. You know, the Bible teaches that there are angels and demons and that Satan is real, but for some reason the thought of fighting him sounds a bit odd. And if that's where you're at, there's two basic reasons why I think you might be tempted to feel that way. Now, not everyone feels that way. Some people have kind of made their peace with that and have a biblical perspective of things. But I'm gonna address some reasons why people might feel a little bit uncomfortable with that thought, or unsure or unclear or not really know what to do with that. The first is that we are deeply influenced by a philosophical system or a philosophical worldview called naturalism. So naturalism, if you don't know, is a philosophical belief that everything that exists can be explained. So the physical world around you, what you see, it can be explained through natural or material causes or explanations. So in this kind of framework, the supernatural explanations for the things that we observe are off the table. They're off limits. They're excluded. So you know, maybe you know that word, maybe you've encountered that word, maybe you don't know that word. That's not really the point. The point is that most people today that you know, and probably you yourself, have tendencies towards naturalism, whether or not you know it. I would say that most people today that are alive in the West, you know, in terms of just America, Europe, people in the West are deeply influenced by naturalism. Naturalism is the air we breathe. It's the fundamental principle that's at work in almost all of the media and entertainment we consume. Atheistic science today is exclusively naturalistic in terms of its worldview, and it's completely hostile to the consideration of supernatural causes or explanations. And so if you want just an example of what I'm talking about, I can give you an example from a silly movie. I'm sorry that Marcus and I have to give children movie example. Sometimes we happen to watch children movies. Sometimes, Marcus loves watching kids' movies. Me, sometimes it's against my will, but I'll do it with a good attitude. If you've heard of the movie Happy Feet, I'll give you an example of naturalism from the movie Happy Feet, okay? So, now, if you know the story, I'm not going to say too much about the movie because, you know, I don't really recommend the movie in general for a lot of reasons. But, I mean, basically, you have the happy penguin who likes to dance, right? You have the happy penguin who likes to dance. And in many ways, it's kind of a critique on religion. And so you have the happy penguin who's a little bit different from all the other penguins. And the happy penguin, he likes to dance. But all the other penguins, they like to sing. And so what happens in the show, if you don't know, spoiler alert, I'm sorry, it's been like years now, so I really don't care at this point if I've ruined it. But the what happens is the religious penguins, there's the religious penguins, and they're upset by the fact that this happy little penguin likes to dance instead of sing. And so, basically, the penguin likes to dance, they can't sing, they're upset about it, and then they threaten that, like, if he keeps on going, all the problems that are happening in their world are because the gods, like the one true penguin god, is displeased with that happy penguin dancing, okay? So that's basically the story. But then what you realize, like going through the movie, is what was the problem? Well, it wasn't that like the one true penguin god, it sounds a lot like the Christian god, was displeased with the happy penguin. What the problem actually was that, you know, Western capitalist Western capitalist, you know, with their oil rig, it caused an oil spill, and now that's ruining the environment. And so really it had nothing to do with, the point is it had nothing to do with the supernatural. The problem they were experiencing had nothing to do with the supernatural. What it was when you know a little bit more and have a broader perspective of the world, one of the things you realize is everything that happens, you don't have to explain it by reference to the supernatural. You can explain it through natural causes. That's naturalism, in short. I mean, that you don't have to understand the word, but just understand the concept. And so, one of the things to realize is that this naturalism is really the air we breathe. When we try to think about the phenomenon that exists in the world, we think primarily and intuitively and very naturally in terms of natural causes and explanations. And we're often very hostile to the idea that there's any supernatural causes that can be at work behind things. And so, you know, if you were to, just to give you another simple, silly example, you know, why does Roman, my son, have blue eyes? You know, we think naturally in terms of just, you know, there's that word again. We think naturally, and we say the word all the time. We think naturally, though, in terms of, well, you know, I must have a recessive blue-eyed gene in my family tree. And Elizabeth has apparently two recessive blue-eyed genes, and so you know he's got the recessive gene from my side, and he has the two genes from her side, and so he gets the blue gene in terms of his eyes. And so when you answer it that way, you're answering it in terms of a natural explanation. But then, isn't there another explanation for why he has blue eyes? Maybe God gave him blue eyes, right? Now, do those things have to be fighting and in conflict? I mean, can't God give him blue eyes, and can't God do that through genetics and everything else? But which explanation do we naturally lean towards? Not that God gave him blue eyes. Well, why? Because that sounds primitive and superstitious and unenlightened and non-scientific. We naturally lean towards the genetic explanation because somehow that seems to be truer. But then fundamentally, as Christians, which is the truer explanation? That God gave him blue eyes. And God made him to have blue eyes. And so, you know, the example I gave in the movie is just an example of part of the way in which we've tried to, in the West, we think that science has come to remove all the primitive superstitions and everything else. And while it may be true that many of the explanations for the world that superstitious and primitive tribes come up with could be helpfully corrected by some 21st century advancements in science and technology, we should also be alert to the danger of thinking about the world solely in materialistic or naturalistic terms. In many ways, the superstitious tribe who believes it is their God who brings the rain and withholds the rain, it's much closer to the truth than 21st century Westerners who believe that the rain comes because of weather patterns, which, you know, the meteorologists often aren't very accurate with their predictions in general. But, I mean, let's just grant that they may be a little bit more accurate than the primitive tribal people. Which explanation is closer to the truth, that God causes the rain to fall on the just or the unjust, or that the rain happens simply as a result of clouds, you know, and weather cycles and everything else? And so I would say that we're deeply influenced by naturalism to such a degree that when a flood happens, what do? I mean, you have a series of, you know, Christian authors who will come out and say that, you know, God is sending his judgment with this flood or with this tornado or with this hurricane. And then you'll have another group of Christian writers who come along and say, God had nothing to do with that. You know, it just happened. It's just random, mindless, impersonal weather that God's just as sorry about as we are. But, you know, from a Christian worldview, we know that God's real and that he exists, and we may not be able to predict all of his reasons for why he sends judgments, but they're much better to, you know, we used to call them acts of God. Now we call them natural disasters, right? So notice our whole dialogue has changed. Our knee-jerk impulse at almost every single point is to describe the world that we see in terms of natural processes. I mean, have you ever watched a religious documentary where they come along and show some of the miracles that Jesus did and try to give natural explanations for how they could have possibly happened that are completely devoid of the supernatural? We live in a culture and in a society that's very deeply suspicious of the supernatural, and I would just warn you to say that you might think that you're immune to that, but you're probably not, okay? And we ought to be aware of that temptation. And so the point here is just to say, as a result, when we talk about fighting the devil, many of us have been deeply influenced by a naturalistic worldview that we're surrounded by. And so that might sound a little bit off or a little bit strange, or I don't really know what to do with that. Second, I would say that that if you feel a little bit unsettled, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, I'm just saying that that might be where some of the hesitancy is coming from. So that's something to think about. A second thing, that if you do feel a little bit unsettled or hesitant or not really sure about what to do with it, what to do with the thought of fighting against the devil, I would say that many of us who are like that probably feel like that because the main people that go around talking about fighting the devil is basically the charismatic church, and many of us want to distance ourselves from that as much as we can, because a lot of the figures of the charismatic movement are, you know, pretty creepy when it comes right down to it. And so, I mean, all you have to do is just look up some Benny Hinn videos on YouTube and see him knocking people down and them convulsing on the ground and waving his coat at them and, you know, doing this stuff, and they're shaking, and, you know, I don't know about you, maybe that's... Elizabeth grew up in a charismatic church, and she feels creeped out now. But when I see that kind of stuff, I'm like, I don't want to be anywhere near that myself. And so I know that for me, there's kind of a hesitancy to talk about a lot of the supernatural, because a lot of the figures in that movement and a lot of the... I mean, you just turn on TBN and see some of the ladies with the, you know, huge hair and the, you know, that kind of stuff happening. And you might get a little bit weird too. I mean, I think we have the charismatic movement is a very big movement that's influencing the church in a wide variety of ways. But when you think about the people who are talking about fighting the devil, I mean, I You're thinking about people who are praying against territorial spirits, who are not slaying people in the spirit, knocking them down. Deliverance ministries where, you know, you're smacking people on the forehead, trying to deliver them from the demon of alcoholism and obesity and everything else. You have Bethel Church, grave sucking. There's a lot of weird stuff out there with a lot of the people who are the main people out front talking about the supernatural. And I would say that despite, you know, some sort of reservations you might have at being associated with some of those things, we can't afford to be embarrassed by the supernatural. In fact, I think it's to our great shame that we don't speak about the supernatural to the degree that we should. And many of us probably aren't as holy as we would be if we would spend a lot more time thinking about the nature of the fight that we have to fight and the, you know, forces, if you will, that are arrayed against us. And so the Bible is a book that presents to us a supernatural worldview. The person who reads the Bible in a straightforward way should have no problem believing that God created the world in 6 days from nothing, sustaining, running, and upholding it by the word of its power. The person who reads the Bible in a straightforward way should have no problem believing that human beings have souls, that we're not just material beings, we have souls, that Jesus was God, the second person of the Trinity, who took on flesh, died as a substitute, and rose from the dead to save sinners, that there's life after death where individuals will spend eternity in either heaven or hell, and that angels, demons, and Satan all exist and are actively, angels and demons are demons and Satan are actively trying to keep the gospel from being spread and to tempt us in a wide variety of ways. And so as it relates to our study today, there really is a great enemy of our souls who is actively seeking to devour us, of whom we need to be made aware and actively learn how to fight. So today we're going to be talking about how to keep from being outwitted by Satan. As the text says in verse 10 through 11, anyone whom you forgive, I also forgive. Indeed, what I have forgiven, if I've forgiven anything, has been for your sake in the presence of Christ, so that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. And so as we think about this passage, one of the first things that might be helpful to talk about is to ask the question, well, who is Satan? Who is he? If we don't want to be outwitted by him, we ought to spend, I guess, at least some time trying to figure out who he is. And for some of you, this might be old information. Maybe for some of you, it's new information. I don't know. But essentially, Satan, if you want to talk about who he is, there's many names in the Bible for him. I'm going to list some of them in just a second. But a good place to start, it would be Isaiah 14, 12. Isaiah 14, 12 through 14 says this: how you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the dawn. O day star, son of the dawn is a reference to Satan. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north, and I will ascend from the heights of the cloud. I will make myself like the Most High. So if you say, who is Satan? Originally, the best we can tell is that he was an angel. And you get that in part from this passage in Isaiah 14, 12. But he was formerly an angel. He tried to lead a rebellion against God that was in heaven before, we believe, before the creation of the world or shortly after the creation of the world, before, you know, we get very far in the Bible at the very least. But towards the beginning of time, shortly, I would say before the creation, shortly after the creation of the world, he led a rebellion against God, and it was an unsuccessful rebellion. The motive of his rebellion was to try to be like the Most High, to supplant God, to replace him, and so he must have been a angel of some sort of significant power, although you know, sin's irrational, and every time we sin, we're trying to do essentially the same thing and experience the same sort of results. But when he fell, he took a third of the angels with him. This is what Revelation tells us. And these angels are now called demons. And so he is essentially, who Satan is he's essentially the ruler of the demons. So who were, you know, former angels or fallen angels. Now hell was originally created to be a place of torment for the devil and his angels, and it still will serve that function at the end. And at the same time, people who do not put their faith in Jesus will also experience torment in hell as well. But nowhere in the Bible does the Bible describe Satan as being the ruler of hell. I think in most popular depictions of Satan, it's pretty common to see Satan, you know, being some red guy with a goatee and, you know, maybe horns or something like that, and a pitchfork, and, you know, people in hell, and he's in there stabbing them or something like that, as if he's in charge. Hell is a place made to torment Satan. I mean, in a very real sense, God is the ruler of hell, not the devil. So it's not like the devil's going to be in. It's not like Greek mythology or something like that, where, you know, you have, you know, Hades in charge of the underworld and Zeus, you know, in charge of wherever it is that he's from, Olympus or whatever. But it's not like that. I mean, it's not like they're two competing deities or something like that of who, you know, have equal power and balance each other out and need each other and are dependent on each other in that sort of way. Hell is a place of torment that's going to be a place of torment for Satan and his angel and the fallen angels, the demons, and anyone who doesn't put their faith in Christ. And so in terms of Satan, you get a better picture about him by thinking about some of his names. And so there's a lot of names and descriptions for Satan in the Bible. Satan means adversary. The word itself, devil, or diabolos in the Greek, means slanderer. So he's an adversary. He's a slanderer. He's often called Abaddon, which is Hebrew for destruction. He's described as the accuser of the brethren, an adversary. He's also named Apollyon in the Greek, which means destroyer. Beelzebul, have you heard of that one before? Beelzebul, I think a Hittite god that was called the Lord of the Flies, and it's attributed to Satan being the ruler of demons because they're like a swarm. Belial, which means worthlessness. So, in the New Testament, people are called sons of Belial. Belial means worthlessness. He's described as a deceiver. The dragon in the book of Revelation, which is carrying on with him being a picture of the serpent in the garden. So that old serpent of old, dragon, he's called the enemy, the evil one, the father of lies, the lawless one, the liar. There's a broader discussion about whether or not he's ever described as Lucifer. The only reference to Lucifer comes from that passage in Isaiah that I just read, where some of the modern translations translate it now as O Day Star instead of Lucifer. Lucifer was kind of a Latin transliteration of that phrase in the Vulgate, if that means anything to you, which probably doesn't, so just ignore it. But there's a discussion about whether or not phrase O Day Star should be a proper name, Lucifer in Latin, or if it's just a description, like a day star, which I think the modern translations probably have it better, but that's just something else. He's described as the murderer, the prince of the power of the air, the ruler of darkness, the ruler of this world, the serpent of old, the son of perdition, the tempter, the thief, and the wicked one. So a lot of good good adjectives there to have attached to your name. Basically, evil incarnate, if you want to put it that way. So who is Satan? I don't know that I want any of those things attributed to me myself, but what are his designs? So the text says we are not ignorant of his designs. What is Satan trying to do? What is his plan? Well, a good passage to think about when if you want to try to summarize his plans in general. We're going to think about another passage, and we're going to talk about how that relates to the passage we're at. But some other passages would be Book of Revelation. So Revelation 12:12 says this. It says, "Rejoice, therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." And then verse 17 of the same chapter, verse 17, 12, 17, so it says the devil has come down to the earth, and he has come down in great wrath because he knows his time is short, okay? So verse 17 says the dragon became furious with the woman which basically symbolizes the church, I think, and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Christ. And so if you want to talk about what is the plan of Satan, or what is his design in broad strokes, what is it? And I would say in a simple way, to cause as much destruction as he can before his time runs out, and to take as many people to hell with him as he can. That's his plan. So he knows his time is short on the earth. He knows he's a defeated foe, but what his plan is, what is his designs? He wants to take, basically, he knows he's a defeated foe with a short amount of time, and at this point, he's not trying to win the fight against God anymore. He's just trying to take as many people with him as he can. So the devil is a defeated foe, and he knows it. And there's I'll give you a few examples of situations like this, some silly and some significant. But World War II, just to give you a historical example, after D-Day, everyone knew that the war was essentially over. I mean, there was a decisive moment in the war, but that didn't mean that Hitler just gave up. Okay, so after D-Day, if he had any sense, he would have given up. He should have known he's fighting a war on two fronts, and he just lost a significant front, and he's not doing very well on the Russian front, and it's done. He should have known that. But do you think he just gives up and says, "All right, let's make peace"? Well, no. At that point, he's so advanced in terms of his evil and his hatred that, his response is to basically be furious and try to take as many people out as he can before he ultimately takes his own life. And so some of the bloodiest battles in World War II happened after D-Day, because Hitler knew his time was short. And basically at that point, it's a matter of taking as many people with him. And so you have some significant bloody battles, like the Battle of the Bulge happened after that. I'll give you a video game example that I'm sure that you can relate to as well. But this is an example limited to video games. It's all example that Marcus and I could share with you with, any number of sports that we played or board games that we played. I could give you board game examples of the same sort of phenomenon. Maybe I will. But just a video game example. There was a game I was playing where you had basically a short amount of time, and the goal was you had to mine a bunch of resources as fast as you possibly can, and then other players were doing the same sort of thing. So everyone's mining resources as fast as you can, and then you would attack other players and try to take their resources. So first you mine, because no one has any resources, so you mine, and then you have to plan your attacks, okay? So you have to plan. You have to say, all right, each attack is going to take 2 minutes or so, and I have 30 minutes to get as many resources as I can so I can win this thing, right? So, but each attack is going to take 2 minutes. So then what you have to think to yourself is, will it take longer will I get more resources from attacking the person or just mining? Do you see? That's the strategy involved. So that's what you have to think about. And so you go about it, the first part you're mining, and then, finally you start attacking. Well, there's sometimes where, the person you attack gets so mad that they give up on trying to win. They don't even want to win anymore. They make it their mission to keep you from winning. So they spend the whole rest of their time like having no thought to like their own personal winning of the competition. They try to find you over and over again and attack you so that you can't mine, and you're not going to get anything from them because you already took everything from them. They know they can't beat you anyways. And so that's just an example, though, of how the devil works. Another example, I mean, it's the same sort of philosophy. It's like, I'm a beaten foe. I know it. I'm no longer trying to win at this point. I'm just trying to take as many people down as I can. There's a line from the movie, I think it's The Dark Knight, where Alfred says of Bane, maybe it's not, I don't know. It's about the Joker? Yeah, okay, you're right. I should have looked it up. Thank you. No, but you know, he does say about the Joker, not Bane. Some people just like to watch the world burn, right? And so, like, there's some sort of evil that's just intent on causing destruction and mayhem. And you know, you can't get your handles on that kind of evil, because most people just, they have something that they're looking after and wanting after and seeking after. But some people just want to watch the world burn. And when you think about the devil, he knows his time is short. He knows he's a defeated foe. He knows that Christ accomplished the victory on the cross. And with the devil at this point, his goal is, like, he's at that irrational point where his hatred is so high that he's not even trying to win a fight anymore. He's just trying to take as many people to hell as he possibly can. So his designs are to cause as much destruction as he can before his time runs out, and to take as many people to hell with him as he can. And so how do his designs relate to this passage? Well, Paul says, anyone whom you forgive, I also forgive. Indeed, what I've forgiven anything has been for your sake in the presence of Christ, so that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. You see, Satan's primary target is the gospel, and that means that forgiveness is always going to be in his crosshairs, okay? So say, if his plan is, he knows he's a defeated foe, and he's trying to take as many people to hell with him as he possibly can, then he knows the way to get people to hell is to get them either to deny the gospel or to embrace a false gospel. And central to the gospel is going to be to attack notions of forgiveness. Do you understand? So because the gospel is fundamentally and primarily about forgiveness. That's what it's about. So why did Jesus die on the cross? Well, if you listen to a lot of popular preachers today, it's very unclear why Jesus would even have to die on the cross, right? So if you listen to Joel Osteen preach, and he's the megachurch pastor in Houston who wrote the book Your Best Life Now, Harrison and I were joking this week about if I were ever to get invited to preach at his church, would that be a good thing? Would I do it or not? And I said, you know, I might, but then I would probably, you know, the title of my sermon would probably be Your Best Life Later or Your Worst Life Now, and see if I get invited back with that sort of thing. But I mean, if you listen to Joel Osteen, you come away from don't listen to Joel, except for just to verify that I'm not like slandering him here, but just don't worry about it. You would come away from the Bible thinking the Bible is fundamentally about God giving man health and happiness and material possessions. And so you have to ask yourself, if that's God's plan to give man health and happiness and material possessions, white teeth and fresh breath and, you know, winning smile and all that, what need is there for the cross with that, right? Or even if you listen to Rick Warren, Purpose-Driven Life and all that, you come away from the Bible thinking the Bible is fundamentally about purpose and meaning and satisfaction. And I would say, If all he was doing was coming to the earth to give us purpose and meaning and satisfaction, what need is there for a cross? Can't he do that without that? And aren't there many people who feel they have a lot of purpose and a lot of meaning and a lot of satisfaction and a lot of the things that they pursue? I mean, isn't that, you know, humanity's basic problem is that you have a lot of people who are finding a lot of satisfaction, purpose, and meaning in a lot of things that they shouldn't be finding it in? And so if you know, God's mission is fundamentally to give us, you know, happiness and health and material possession and fundamentally about giving us purpose and meaning and satisfaction, then really the cross doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But when you read through the Bible, one of the things you realize is that Jesus died on the cross most fundamentally, I'm not saying that like there's not implications for his death that also do some of those things, at least in this life and some of those things in the next. But Jesus died on the cross most fundamentally to save sinners, delivering them from his wrath. This is why Jesus had to die. Jesus didn't have to die on the cross if his plan was simply to keep you happy and healthy and give you things and give you purpose and meaning and satisfaction. He could have done all those things without the need for a bloody cross. But he had to die on the cross in order to give sinners forgiveness. And if he didn't, he would not be both just and the justifier of those who put their faith in Christ Jesus. So one of the things we have to ask is, why is the Bible climax in the story of Jesus dying on the cross? And the reason why is because fundamentally man's most basic need is forgiveness from God. So fundamentally and most primarily, we need to be reconciled to God. And then in a secondary sense, we need to be reconciled to our fellow man as well. And the only way that that's going to be really possible, truly possible, in any sort of lasting way is if Jesus died on the cross and we receive the forgiveness from him that we most desperately need. And so the reality is you're never more like God than when you joyfully forgive those who ask, and you are never more like the devil when you refuse in wickedness to forgive those who sin against you. And that's, you know, exactly what this passage is talking about. When you read through the passage, one of the things that you see in a very clear way is that Paul is saying, he's having a discussion about forgiveness. He says, indeed, what I've forgiven, if I've forgiven anything, has been for your sake in the presence of Christ, so that we would not be outwitted by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his designs. What are his designs? His designs are to keep church members, in part, his designs are to keep church members from practicing forgiveness with each other. Because if he keeps church members from practicing forgiveness with each other, in many ways, what he's doing is he's preventing them from seeing the value of forgiveness. And most likely, I mean, if we're characterized by a lack of forgiveness, we're showing strong evidence that we don't even know God or understand the forgiveness that God has to offer. And so, Matthew 6:14 says, "If you forgive others their trespasses." Your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive you your trespasses. God is in the business of granting sinners forgiveness when they ask, and helping to reconcile fellow sinners to both him and each other. Satan is in the business of doing everything possible to keep us from humbling ourselves and asking God to forgive us, and to keep ourselves from humbling ourselves to others and asking forgiveness and granting forgiveness from each other. And so, as I said, you know, you're never more like God than when you joyfully forgive those who ask, and you're never more like the devil than when you refuse in wickedness to forgive those who sin against us. So what are Satan's designs? In short, he knows he has a short time. He's raging against the church, doing everything possible to keep us from being forgiven by God and forgiving each other, okay? So if we are to fight against the devil, the first thing we really need to do is to understand Satan's designs. And I've already described what his designs are, but then the second thing that we need to do, step two, would be to take decisive action against his designs. And so the text says, indeed, what I've forgiven, if I've forgiven anything, has been for your sake in the presence of Christ, so that we would not be outwitted by Satan. Paul, in his mind, in terms of taking a decisive action against the designs of Satan, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, if you want to fight the devil, how do you fight him? You forgive your brothers and sisters when they ask, because his plan is to drive a wedge in between people and God, in between fellow church members and others, so that he can ruin their witness and keep them from realizing and accepting the forgiveness God has for him. So Paul thinks about, you know, decisive action against the devil fundamentally as not allowing anything to happen that'll keep us from having a right relationship with God, and not allowing anything to happen that will allow us to keep to have a right relationship with others. And so I think many times when we think about fighting the devil and taking action against it, I don't think we're thinking about it in such simple kind of terms as that. I mean, the Bible gives a pretty simple battle plan against the devil. I'm not going to say everything about it today. I'll say a few things, but I won't say everything about it today. But it's a fairly simple battle plan. And none of it really involves, you know, sassing the devil or talking to the devil. I mean, you don't have to sing a song like, you know, tell the, you don't have to triumphantly tell the devil, no, not today, or something like that. You don't have to do any of that. I mean, I've never talked to Satan once in my life. And one of the things to realize about Satan is he's like a local being. So what I mean by that is God's omnipresent, God's everywhere. But Satan, he's just an angel. So Satan, he's a powerful angel, and he's in charge of a bunch of angels. But you know what? Like, I don't think Satan has probably ever taken any time whatsoever in real life to do anything with me at all. I'm sure that his demons have at some point. But Satan himself, I mean, I'm just not that important, okay? And so I'm not going to go around telling the devil, not, no, not today, because, like, one, I'm not that important in the whole scheme of the world to think that the devil would personally come visit me and personally tempt me. And I'm sure that there's much bigger people on the priority list than me, for one. But then also, the Bible has a lot to say about false teachers, and false teachers are those who speak evil of authority figures. And so Jude 1, 8 through 10 says this, yet, it's talking about false teachers, yet in like manner these people also, relying on their dreams, defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones, that means angels, blaspheme angels. But when the archangel Michael, contending with the devil, was disputing about the body of Moses, he did not presume to pronounce a blasphemous judgment, but he says, the Lord rebuke you. But those people, they blaspheme all they do not understand, and they are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. We don't need to run around, you know, cursing the devil, telling him off, having an attitude towards him or anything like that. I mean, the reality is Satan is much smarter than me. He's been around a lot longer than me. He's a lot more powerful than me. And he has a lot more, authority in a lot of ways than I do. And so that doesn't mean you have to be afraid of the devil. The Bible gives you everything you need to resist the devil. But at the same time, you ought to have some sort of caution where you are not just running your mouth at people who are individual beings who really are given much more temporary authority than you were given at this time. And so the Bible doesn't really call us to be people who were sassing the devil in some sort of way like that. The devil, basically, if you want to think about how do you actually fight him, you don't have to do all that. You're not running around, you know, sprinkling holy water all over your dwelling or, you know, commanding demons and Satan to get away from you and doing all this kind of stuff. Basically, the devil, in terms of his plot, the devil is a liar, and he wants you to think that following God is too hard. And in one of the primary ways that we fight the devil is not by any of those things that I mentioned, but just by trying to identify the lies that you are currently being tempted to believe. And so as it relates to the subject of forgiveness, the devil has a lot of lies that he is encouraging a lot of people to believe that are related to that subject, lies that we fall into all the time. So the devil, he's a liar. He wants you to think that the forgiveness is too hard, that it's too painful, that there's some things that are just too heinous to forgive. So, I mean, I want you to think about your life and think about situations where you have broken relationships with people and relationships that need to be reconciled. The devil wants you to think that it's too hard. It's too painful. Some things are too heinous. He wants you to rationalize your lack of forgiveness, and he wants you to surround yourself with sycophants who make allowances for you and tell you that it's okay not to forgive, too dangerous to forgive, or that it would be too awkward to forgive. You know that our primary notion of friendship right now in our society is to have a person who tells you everything that you're thinking and feeling and wanting is absolutely right and justified. And that's intuitively what we want in a friend, even if we don't say that that's what we want in a friend. What you want when you're seeking a friend, this is what people want when they're seeking a counselor. They want someone who's going to justify everything that they think and justify everything that they believe. And you know what? The moment that you say, hey, I don't think what you're thinking or feeling right there is right, it's like almost as if you just slap someone, right? That's the way people respond. Like, how dare you speak to me that way? You're not my friend. You didn't tell me what I want you to hear. So what does the devil want you to do? He wants you to surround yourself with a bunch of people who are going to make excuses with you and tell you you don't have to forgive, or it's too hard to forgive, or that you're in the right and the other person is in the wrong, and to reinforce your perspective on things. He wants you to see yourself as a damaged and broken victim who could never grant forgiveness to your abuser. He wants you to wait and forgive until you see enough fruit in the other person. So he wants you to postpone forgiveness. Wait until you see enough fruit. He wants you to tell others that you forgive them with your mouth, but then he wants you to avoid them and feel hurt and feel bitter at them and still bash them over the head with their record of wrongdoing every time they sin against you again. So Satan's plans are to get you to do everything possible to either reject the notion of forgiveness outright or to say that you're practicing forgiveness when you're actually not. So how do we fight against Satan? Well, according to this passage, we freely offer forgiveness to those who sin against us. We commit to releasing the debt and no longer holding their sins over their head if they ask us. That's how you fight Satan. So what does that mean in this situation, in the situation we're talking about in the passage? What meant that a church member needed to be welcomed back into the fellowship, and you had a lot of people who were nervous about not knowing what to do with it. And Satan and his plan is to keep people in disunity, keep people in disharmony, keep them from being a proper picture of the gospel in the lives of the church, to keep them from properly being reconciled to their maker in general. And so how do you fight the devil? Well, I think as it relates to this passage, one of the main ways that you can fight the devil is that you realize personally that God is a forgiving God and that he stands ready to forgive you when you ask, and that there's nothing that you can do for the past, present, or future that can separate you from his love if you're his. And that when you sin, you don't need to be distant from God. When you sin against him, you don't have to run away from God and be distant from God. And you don't have to, wait a little bit to ask forgiveness until you can clean yourself up and figure it out and do the right thing again. What God wants you to do is to realize that when you sin against him, you need to come to him and you need to confess it. And he stands willing to forgive. That's why he died on the cross. He's died on the cross to forgive us our trespasses and to remember, cast them into the depths of the sea and to remember them no more. And not only did he do that so that we would do that, that we would quickly come to him and ask forgiveness to him, he did that so that we don't have to be fundamentally distanced from each other in the same sort of way. You know, the secret to good relationships is that you have people who know and understand and love the concept of forgiveness. And so when we sin against each other, it ought not to be the same kind of thing that we do with God. We don't have to run away from God and hide from God and feel embarrassed, feel ashamed, and never talk about it again and try to, clean yourself up before we go ask forgiveness. The natural air we should breathe in the relationships that we have with other people should be that we are quick and eager and ready to come and to be reconciled with other people, because the devil's plan is to divide us from God and divide us from others, but God's plan is that we be reconciled to him and be reconciled to our fellow believers.
We are so encouraged that you chose to engage with God's Word on our Provenance podcast. For more biblical teaching, resources, media, and to financially support the mission of Provenance, please visit ProvenanceChurch.com. Until next time, go equip one another to embody humanity's one true purpose.